Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Bettina Göring about the documentary that she's involved with and that's screening this coming weekend. And we will be talking to Robert Sinn, cabaret singer. I'm delighted now to welcome Margaret Atwood. She is the author of over 40 books of fiction, poetry, and prose. Her latest novel is The Year of the Flood. She, along with her partner, Graham Gibson, will be at the Lenzik Center for Performing Arts on Monday, November 17th at 7 in the evening. It's a benefit for Wild Earth Guardians, co-sponsored by Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this novel is set in some time in the unspecified but not too distant future in which a viral pandemic has wiped out most of the human race. And those who survive were people who were isolated in one way or another. They were quarantined or in jail or whatever. As you wrote this novel, did you imagine it as an extrapolation of the present, but basically realism? Or something, I know you don't like the term science fiction, but something more in that direction of fantasy?
I don't mind the term science fiction. I just like to have it used precisely. So if one does use it, one has to say which lineage of science fiction it belongs to. And it belongs to the lineage that began with Jules Verne writing about things that might possibly be invented and happen and went on through 1984 and Brave New World and things like Ridley Walker and Death of Grass by John Wyndham. So things that could happen on this planet as opposed to a galaxy far, far away or invasion by squid-like monsters and tin cans. So there are two lines of it. So I'm of the first line, and you can call it science fiction if you want, but you have to then put a little subset saying this kind. Anyway, could it happen? No question. We have all of the tools for such an event in our hands right now, and that would be the fact that we've cracked the DNA code, and students and universities are happily now slicing and dicing to make little viruses of their own. So it's entirely conceivable. Will it happen? Well, not necessarily, because we have invented the hydrogen bomb and we haven't yet blown all of ourselves up with it. So we don't always use our edge tools destructively as soon as we've got them. But is it possible? Sure. As for the rest of the future in this book, we have those tools as well. So I wouldn't call it necessarily wild, made-up, deep, dark, gothic invention on my part. You might call it wild, inventive, deep, dark invention on the part of the human race who invents these things.
Right. The metaphor of the waterless flood has obviously biblical connotations, mankind being punished for their sins, and in this case, the sins are in part ecological, or in very large part ecological, the tigers and the elephants and rhinoceroses.
Man-made species extinctions, which are going on right now. So whatever you may think of the cause of global warming, there is no doubt that the extinctions are being caused by us. So my group, called the God's Gardeners, take bits of scripture quite seriously, and like every other religious group, they cherry pick scripture to suit themselves and reinterpret it according to their own frame. But there's enough in there to support their views, for sure. And I don't know whether you know about the Green Bible yet, but it has made an appearance among us. It's got linen covers, it's got ecologically correct paper, it's got the green parts in green. It's got an introduction by Archbishop Tutu and a lot of green things that you can do at the end. And it takes the stewardship view as opposed to let's destroy it all, let it all burn, and God will make another one. So there are those two views right now on the planet, and there's already a green movement within Western North American Christianity, and some of the other world religions actually never lost their green roots. Let's mention Buddhism and Hinduism, and even the Quran, which is pretty specific about the rights of animals.
Let's talk for a moment about this religious group in the novel called God's Gardeners, to which many of the characters in the book are linked. And you give us their hymns, their poems, sermons.
Yes,
by the...
they're hymns, not poems.
Yeah.
Poems are there for, they have to make aesthetic sense, whereas hymns are a different kind of thing. They're almost always in verse. They are sung by congregations. You know, they're for congregational singing to celebrate events in the religions or commemoration, celebration. A lot of them are special occasion hymns. If you go into the hymn book, you see ones recommended for this or that occasion. And their primary purpose is not aesthetic. Their primary purpose is unification of the group around key events in the religion. So that's what my hymns are like, and for that reason, some of the lines in them are not perfect poetically, just like real hymns.
Right.
So they are like real hymns. And when I was writing them, I didn't envisage them having new music. I wrote them in my head according to already existing hymn tunes, and a lot of religious groups have done that. They've taken existing hymn tunes and rewritten the words to be consistent with their own beliefs. And even middle-range Christianity is constantly revising the hymns, changing lines in them. Did you know that? It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Even some of John Bunyan's lines they've changed to get rid of words like hobgoblins and things. So yes, that's what my group does. But then along came a musician-composer who happens to be my literary agent's partner, and he started reading the manuscript when it was still just a manuscript. And he started suddenly having the hymn tunes in his head, so he just wrote them down. And now he's made a CD called Hymns of the God's Gardeners, and it's those hymns that we've been using in the musical and dramatic events that we have been doing. So it all just came about by sort of coincidence.
People can find them on the website yearoftheflood.com. You can actually listen to them and download them.
Yes, they're also on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and other websites like that. So it's the... If you want the audio track, there it is.
Right. It's so interesting. The God's Gardeners are a religion who have a theology that's really a fusion of scripture and science. And I have to say, it felt entirely plausible. Are there any groups that are doing this? Is this based on any actual religion?
I think it's going that way. It's a blend of science, religion, and nature. And some of the positions in Adam One's sermonettes are not my own invention. They have a tradition behind them. So although some of the readings, for instance, not everybody would interpret the passage where Jesus says, "Come with me and I'll make you fishers of men," not everybody would interpret that as care for the fish by removing two fishermen from the fisherman pool. But you might read it that way. Some of the other theological positions, however, have long tradition. So are there any groups that are going that way? I think increasingly Western Christianity, which separated from its green roots in the late 17th and 18th centuries when it was confronted by a mechanistic view of the universe, took the position that animals were basically machines. I think they are now reconnecting with their earlier, much greener roots. Go into any medieval cathedral, and what do you see carving around the pillars and on the pews and in the stained glass windows and decorations? You see a lot of creatures and plant life, because the inside of the cathedral was supposed to be a mirror of the universe, and that included everything that had been created. And the human scenes took place within that.
I think it's important and interesting that the way the book is set up, the way this religion is set up, there is no inherent conflict between religion and science, which is something that we are confronted with in our daily life, that this apparent opposition between those two things.
Well, it's not an opposition if you take the view that that the word knowledge should apply to things that you can actually know and test, and the word faith should apply to things that you believe in. And I think one thing that happened to Christianity in the 19th century was that it went materialistic. It felt that it had to justify its beliefs in a materialistic way, in the same way that science was testing and proving things. And that simply removes meaning from the word faith. You know, if it's not a question of, if everything has to be a question of knowledge, then you have to be able to submit it to a materialistic proof. Our gardeners take the opposite view. They say that things of the spirit are of the spirit, much as traditional Christianity has always said, and that spirits are not things. Therefore, any idea that you have to be able to measure spirits by electrical charges or spiritons or any other such device, that just goes out the window because spirits are not material things. Don't you think that makes sense?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the Apostles' Creed says God is a spirit, right?
Right.
In other words, God isn't a thing. God doesn't
right.
have a body.
Yeah, and I guess the thing is, we're in this sort of ridiculously constructed, or I think ridiculously constructed, political situation in which you have...
Well, you have people denying physics, chemistry, geology, archaeology,
exactly.
Deep history, DNA. That's all part of the material world, and therefore subject to material proof. And they're insisting that material world is in fact the same as the world of faith.
So in this historical moment in which you and I are living and sitting here talking on the radio, it is possible to both deeply love humanity and deeply love the rest of the natural world and witness the one destroying the other. And when I was reading The Year of the Flood, I felt, I guess I have to say, little or no sadness about the decimation of the human race. It was almost a kind of relief.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, well, there is that uh-oh moment,
and I have had people say similar things to me, and I think, boy, you know, unless we're willing to, there is another pathway, and that would be to change our ways now.
Exactly, but I mean, in the book, they haven't done that.
No, they haven't done it, no.
I mean, it's really, in a way, a call to us to be good gardeners, to be good guardians of life on Earth.
Well, if you want to continue, I mean, it isn't the whole natural world that man is going to succeed in destroying, because our human race is going to go before that happens. We are not going to be able to wipe out every microbe on the planet, but we are going to be able to do a pretty good job on ourselves.
Well, do you yourself feel that? I mean, when I thought, gosh, it's so good that most of them are gone, now the Earth can get back to its own business, I thought, boy, that's a pessimistic view. I mean, do you feel that way yourself?
Not really, because if I did feel that way, I wouldn't bother writing books, would I? Because what are books but human communication? So they're based on the idea that people can communicate with other people and that's a worthwhile thing to do. And also, as I've gone about now in 7 countries talking about all of this stuff, you would be astonished at how much grassroots activity there is out there. The people on the ground are, in a way, way ahead of the politicians on this. And it goes everywhere from soil conservation to water conservation to green technologies being invented to local initiatives to nature conservancy. There's a lot of activity. Not enough, but there's a lot. So it's definitely it's growing in awareness and it's growing in activity. And people are getting involved on quite a scale. And I have to say, in connection with the God's Gardeners, that you don't do that simply for rational considerations. It has to be emotional. You don't put that kind of commitment into something unless you have an emotional attachment with that which you're trying to save.
We're talking to author Margaret Atwood about her new book, The Year of the Flood. The Religion in the book is full of saints, and I loved the choice of saints. A lot of them were environmentalists, and some of them I'd never heard of, and some of them are very well known. Diane Fossey and Karen Silkwood, and I think
Rachel
Peter,
Carson, Rachel Al Gore. Gore.
Exactly.
E.O. Wilson.
But then some of them, was it your hope that we would stop reading for a moment and go look these people up?
If you wish, you can certainly do that. They're all online.
So St. Alexander Zawadzki, for example.
He's online.
A Polish communist of the early 20th century.
Well, he was a Polish environmentalist.
So they're basically all the saints are environmentalists of one kind or another.
They have to have had that. That's why they get to be saints. How they behaved in the rest of their life is not of much interest to the gardeners. It's only their environmental work or their work as naturalists that counts with the gardeners. So St. Francis is in there, of course, but only for his sermon to the fishes and things like that.
This book, I hope, will serve as a kind of vaccine against the disease of unrestricted corporate capitalism, I guess.
Well, it's when corporate capitalism and government become the same thing that you're really in trouble. Then you're really in trouble. It's what the Soviet Union was like, only kind of backwards. The government was the corporations, and in my book, the corporations are the government. But either melding of those things is really not good for ordinary citizens because they have no recourse. They've got no way of, they have no control over the media. They can't say, I'm being poisoned by the mercury in the water. They can't say any of that. They have no power to go up against it. So you don't want a combination of government and business in that way.
And not far off from where we are now in many living examples, obviously.
Well, when the big financial meltdown happened and governments started pouring their money into banks and automobile companies, I thought, I'm not sure you really want that to happen. But what was the choice?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like 1984, only with much more of a focus on the environment.
Well, 1984 was the Soviet Union model. That was when the governments are the businesses. And ours in this book, and the one that we find ourselves closer to at the moment, is the businesses are the government. So it's them calling, it's whoever's calling the shots.
There's one more thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is that the characters in this book, some of them are also in your previous novel, Oryx and Crake, which I now have to go read, but I was reading about that, and it's same time, some of the same people, different focus. Why did you choose to go back to that time and place and set of characters?
My earlier work was done in the Victorian novel. Those novels were often quite long, and a lot of them are written in serial form. But they often had chapters called Meanwhile, or that began Meanwhile. And you knew when you came to the Meanwhile chapter that it was the same world. It was the same time frame, but it was other people in a different place. And you also knew that sooner or later, the people in the Meanwhile chapter were going to meet up with the people in the chapter you had just read. So there would be a meeting of those two characters, and they would all be, of those two character sets, and they would all be worked in somehow. And so you might think of Year of the Flood as the Meanwhile chapter. It's the same time. It's a group that's going to converge with the characters in the other book, and there's a lot of overlap in their stories. So what I wanted to do was look at a different part of the map. Oryx and Crake takes place within the elite, within the very gated communities that are now the big corporate and scientific enterprises. They actually have walls around them, which they kind of do now. And the Year of the Flood involves people who are very much not the elite. In fact, they're in the places in that society which are the most violent, most lawless, most out of control, most impoverished places in the society.
And I suppose it's no coincidence that in the first one it's the men who are the main characters, and the second it's the women.
Well, again, we're looking at a different part of the society, and it's true that we follow two female characters. We also follow a male character, namely Adam One, who is the leader of the gardeners. We follow him and his group.
You are going to be doing a reading here in Santa Fe on Tuesday, November 17th, and a question and answer with Graham Gibson, who we also are having on this show with his wonderful new book, The Bedside Book of Beasts.
Yes.
You've also been doing these tours that are more like literary performances. Tell us about that work.
Okay. Yes. Okay. So how that all came about was, first of all, we had this music, which had just kind of happened by accident, and then my friends in BirdLife International, of which I'm not only a member but the honorary joint president of the Rare Bird Society within it, and it's in 108 countries. It's very, very groundbreaking international bird conservation, bird and people conservation society, because what's killing birds now is going to kill us later unless we clean it up. So they said to me, how do we get our message out to people who are not in the bird world? And I said, through the arts. And then we looked at each other. So it turned into a combination book launch, musical and dramatic events with three actors reading the parts of Wren, Toby, and Adam One, and a singing group doing the songs, and a fundraiser for whatever environmental organization was associated with bird life or parallel to bird life. And that's how all of that came about. And we started in the UK, and the idea was just to anybody taking on one of these events decided how to do it on their own. They picked the actors, they picked the singers. I would turn up in the city and have a big surprise, because I would not have known what they were doing. If you go on the blog, which is on www.yearoftheflood.com, and start at the bottom and roll up, you can see pictures of all the events and how, with what variety they have been done. Everything from church choirs to three individual women singers to student groups to two people working in a bookstore and another one who was a customer. We've done them in cathedrals, we've done them in churches, we've done them in theaters, we've done them in auditoriums, and we're doing the very last one in Chicago, the last U.S. one, and the last one of all is in a northern Canadian city which has regenerated itself from having nothing growing in it. Over 40 years they've brought it back, and they've now got forests and trout in the streams. It was where the astronauts trained to be on the moon, and now it's completely changed through volunteer work. So we felt that that would be a very good place to do the final event, and its name is Sudbury, Ontario.
Well, we are just about out of time, but I want to thank you, Margaret Atwood, for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Great. Why don't you play one of the hymns?
Well, I wanted to ask you, do you have a favorite?
I've got a number of favorites, but I think if you want something peppy, you might play The Holy Weeds, which has a lot of instructive information about what you can eat out of your own backyard if push comes to shove.
Okay,
and
great.
If things get quite weedy.
Thank you so much.
And thank you.
Margaret Atwood will be in Santa Fe along with her partner Graham Gibson, and the two of them will discuss their newly published books, The Year of the Flood and The Bedside Book of Beasts. And that's on Tuesday, November 17th at 7 o'clock at the Lenzick Center for Performing Arts in Santa Fe. It's a benefit for Wild Earth Guardians, and there's also a benefit party beforehand. You can get tickets and more information by calling Carol Norton at 505-988-9126, extension 1150, or by going to wildearthguardians.org. The event is co-sponsored by Garcia Street Books. And for our Albuquerque listeners, Margaret Atwood and Graham Gibson will be at Woodward Hall on the University of New Mexico campus on Monday, November 16th at 7 o'clock in the evening. Again, call Carol at 505-988-9126, extension 1150, for more information.
Sing we now the holy weeds, flourish in the ditch. For they are for the meek in need, they are not for the rich. You cannot buy them at the mall, nor at the superstore. They are despised because they all grow freely for the poor. The dandelion shoots for spring before the flowers burst. The burdock root is best in June when it is fat.
I'm happy now to welcome Bettina Göring. She is part of a film called Bloodlines, which is screening this Friday, the 13th of November, at the Jean Cocteau Theater, also known as the New Mexico Film Museum. It's a free event. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi. I'm so glad to be here.
It's great to have you here. Now, this documentary, Bloodlines, is a film in which we see you in your being here on the planet as grandniece of Hermann Göring, who played a major and rather horrible role in the Holocaust.
Exactly.
And you grew up with that legacy. You hooked up with an artist in Australia named Ruth Rich, who was Jewish and was doing paintings dealing with being from a Holocaust survivor family, and the two of you started corresponding. How did that happen, and where did it go?
Yeah, so it's a very interesting story. The way it happened was all through mutual friends. I had a good friend who I used to live with here in the States, and she was Australian. She moved back there. And one day I wrote her an email, I think, saying, one day I will write a book how I've come to terms with my legacy. And then she also knew Ruth, and Ruth had never really dealt with any of those issues until she did these paintings. And then she was an old friend of Ruth for 20 years, I think, and then one day said to Ruth, well, at her exhibition you should meet Bettina, because you guys would be very interesting to get together. And that friend of mine, she was into this peace movement called the Peace Flame. You ever heard of that? It's people, they take like, it's a yoga thing. One of the guys, one of the nephews of Gandhi's next followers, started that in England. And they take the peace flame, like the Olympic flames, all over the world to bring people together from different, like Palestine and Israeli conflicts in Sarajevo, or like the likes of us, and bring them together and create some peace. And that was the idea. That's how it all started.
It's sometimes, at moments, rather an awkward film to watch, because here is this woman, Ruth Rich, a wonderful painter, she's very good, who is kind of later in life, her children are long grown, examining the pain and grief from the Holocaust and kind of putting it on you.
She sure did, yeah, I know. It was, I mean, if I maybe would have known the whole impact, what it would have done beforehand, maybe I wouldn't have gone so readily, but it didn't seem like it was going to be such an encounter. I mean, I had glimpses of it, but I thought, anyways, I need to do this for myself or for whatever, just for my own healing. And so I went, and I expected it to be a few days, and it took 3 weeks, and until I kind of put an end to it, you know, myself, and said, okay, enough of this already. But it was much more intense than I expected.
Let's talk about your part of it. Certainly there has been, in Germany and in the entire post-World War II diaspora, a great deal written about and films made about and songs and literature and everything about the Jewish experience of the Holocaust, but not very much about the descendants of people who really did the bad deeds in Germany.
Very good point. Yeah, and of course, since it's all shame and guilt, I mean, nobody wants to talk about that very much. And I've been dealing with it in some ways from very early on, because what the filmmaker leaves out of the film, half of my family was fascist, half of my family was anti-fascist. And there was like a grandfather and grandmother of each side left that were sort of warring it out, and then my parents were neither. I wouldn't even say my father was at all, even though he was born into that family. But it was that older generation. So all that was fighting each other in me, so to speak. And I try to deal with it, like, as in becoming, you see in the film, you know, I became a hippie, a communist, got into the 60s, whatever, you know, movement. But I've been trying to deal with it in some way or another for a long time, like compared to Ruth, who only started dealing with it much later. What we all have in common, though, and that I'm starting to learn later, is none of our parents could really deal with it. It was too painful. Like, the grandparents would be in total denial, or like my grandmother was a Nazi till the end of her days. She just would even say it didn't even exist, the Holocaust. And she was in every other way a Nazi. That's the way she behaved, how she behaved even to my mom or my mom's family.
What did that look like?
She was like upper class and everybody else was not as good as she. And she treated everybody horribly. Like, she would call them these people. This Pöbel. Do you know what that means? You speak German. I mean, it's a very down-putting name for, like, working class people or something, yeah?
So it's very much an us and them kind of thing at its root, obviously, but maybe not so obviously, because it's not just Jews during the Nazi time and war resistors and so on who were the object of scorn. It was almost everybody.
Yeah, it was everybody. I mean, in her case, what added to it was her class thing. So, I mean, that's how I experienced it. For me, like, the Nazis and the upper class was the same thing in her persona, what I grew up with, and what I kind of detested from day one.
One of the things I found striking and kind of sad watching your role in this film, Bettina, was that you at a certain point made a permanent decision, a surgical decision, not to have children because you didn't want to pass on whatever that was.
Yeah.
Did you think that that kind of Nazism was genetic?
Not really, but still, it was somewhere subconscious, I think, in there. I mean, like, my conscious mind, of course, says, sure, you know, I can do whatever I want, but don't underestimate, like, these very deep-seated feelings of shame or guilt, and it's not even mine. It's my parents, it's my grandparents, it's, like, the whole of Germany, who have it somehow subconscious. And since, even though so much, like you said, Holocaust stuff has been dealt with in Germany, really, nobody really wants to go to this guilt thing. It's so painful, you can imagine. I mean, what do you think? Like, in our generation, we rebelled, of course, but you hear some of your ancestors were mass murderers. What do you think of that? You know, how do you reconcile? And in my particular case, it's like in my family. And it's not just me who didn't have children. My whole mom's side, hardly anybody had children. And that they weren't Nazis. So, I mean, it's a whole sort of generation. The next generation, like more, I guess, in the ones born in the 60s, was already different. But I think it was us who was just after the war and maybe born in the 50s, a lot of us didn't have children. And I'm sure that plays into it, that there was so much, you could say, unfinished karma. I mean, not dealt with emotions so much. It was just hushed up. So it was like, first everybody was destroyed. All the men were gone. Then they had to rebuild. And when I was born, they were already calling it the Wirtschaftswunder, which means everything was growing again. Sometimes that happens.
The business, the economic wonder, the economic miracle.
Exactly. And so everything was bright and easy, as if the other stuff never happened. Yeah, there was like in some programs and in school a little bit about the Holocaust, but it was like nobody wanted to go there, really.
At the same time, more literature dealing with, and films and so on, and theater dealing with the Holocaust has come out of Germany. I've never known of any culture that has really dealt, and actually I think matured so much from their own, let's say, guilt, or, you know, they did a bad thing, they lost, they were exposed,
right.
And then they dealt with it culturally.
They did, yeah, and that's really a wonderful thing, too, that I think happened in Germany. Like, we had lunch the other day, and I said, Germany, thanks to Hitler, is probably never going to start a war again. And I believe that because it's so turned itself. I mean, it's so looked at all that. And still, people like the likes of me, you still have that stuff to deal with, you know. Even though it's even worse or better, I don't know how to say it, that it's not directly mine. I think I can actually deal with it better because it's not directly mine. There's another documentary I'm also part of that's called Hitler's Children. And there was the daughter of Amon Göth, you know, it's the guy from Schindler's List. She was interviewed, and she's a bit older than me, and she didn't deal with that until much later. And only Schindler's List actually showed her what her father was like. Can you imagine?
Very interesting.
I mean, that must have been so shocking. I feel for her, you know. I mean, she was, like, destroyed, and she was this very sweet lady. Her father was also killed in 46, I mean, hanged. And there's again that denial. Like, I mean, the people who really were part of it, they would not say we did something wrong. The other ones who were maybe not the perpetrators directly, but I think they looked at it, their kids looked at it, our generation, you know, from the 60s definitely looked at it.
We're talking to Bettina Göring, and the film Bloodlines will be screening this coming Friday, the 13th of November, at the Jean Cocteau Theater here in Santa Fe. It does really bring up a set of questions which I think are worthy of discussion and introspection, which is, what are the psychological legacies of ancestral trauma? How real is it? How culturally instilled is it? Do you have deep guilt and shame among the descendants of Turkish Americans who were involved in the Armenian genocide, which really didn't get very much publicity compared to the Holocaust?
Right, right.
I don't know the answer to that question.
I don't either. I'm sure, you know, like that we, I believe we, not just culturally, but I think in our DNA we have all the experiences of mankind. Not just of our, like, German experience or Armenian experience or Jewish experience. I think it's all in us. In some way, and whether, I mean, this is more on a personal level that I've experienced it and had to sort of expose that part of myself in order just to heal. But I bet you the Turkish culture, just by denying it, or the Japanese culture, just by denying that they did all that stuff with the Chinese, which they are still doing to this day by never apologizing, there's a lot of trouble because of that with their kids. So there is, like, and it doesn't have to be so direct, you know. I mean, every German friend of mine, whether their people, their parents were involved or not, when they see, like, a train going, like, to Auschwitz kind of thing, their stomach turns. What do you think?
There is a kind of balance between that which is embodied in the slogan, never again, which implies never forget, and then on some level, the need to let go of pain and guilt and anger and move on. So on one hand, never forget, but on the other hand,
right,
do let go. And that's also a tricky balance, which I think you explore on some level in that film, Bloodlines.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it was about for me. I mean, I had been exploring it on so many different levels, and that was for me really a real healing in order to really drop it. But I had to heal it first in myself, in order to really drop it. Same with Ruth. She had to maybe do what she did in that Bloodlines documentary in order to drop it finally. And I think she's painting all these ghosts. Us holding on to it keeps those poor ghosts still with us.
At least for a moment.
Yes. Yeah.
I guess that's what I like. I mean, it's, I have to say, it wasn't always pleasant to watch every single minute of the film, but it definitely does bring up these questions and not answer it in a way that I think is very productive, and I'm glad you're going to have a question and answer and a discussion period after the film.
Exactly. I mean, that is a very stirring up documentary, and that's why I like it. It brings up all sorts of stuff about everybody's good and evil potential, and it's not just about Nazis and Jews. I mean, it can be used for anything. And it's really good to talk about it, which kind of would bring a joint healing afterwards.
Now, you found healing and you went on with your life here in the United States through partially becoming a doctor of Oriental medicine.
Right, yeah, that is, of course, that other side of me, the healing side. I mean, the reason I even did this in the first place is that healing side of me, that I know, you know, what I can do to get to that place. And I'm very grateful for all that. And part of it, I mean, it's a sort of therapy we were doing there with each other, even though it was very spontaneous and not planned. But if I look at it from Oriental medicine perspective, it's like, yeah, you need to get to the root of it and then you can move on and heal. And it's a spiritual, I mean, it's a spiritual healing that was needed there.
Have you found it productive to be with other descendants of Nazis?
I had never attempted to, but the moment I left Germany, which I did very early, I was 19, I kept running into them. And each was, we were pulling each other together, you could say. And they are attracted to us as much as we to them. The descendants from, I mean, that's my experience, from friends I've met. That.
Wait, who's attracted to who?
The descendants of the Holocaust as much as to the descendants of the Nazis. I mean, there's so many friends I have who have this German-Jewish connection. I mean, there's so many people who left Germany. They were, I mean, they thought of themselves as German, not as Jews. So they have that same cultural background. They miss it, you know.
So you, in cultural ways, have very similar heritage.
Of course.
And then in political ways are on two sides of the line.
Not necessarily. Not us as descendants. We're often on the same side of the line.
I Interesting. Mean, so where does this all sit for you now? Is there...
What has happened for me, I have for a long time in my life just like sort of lived with my mother's family, who are the good guys, so to speak, and I've started to forgive or accept my father's side of the family. And interesting enough, they've started to contact me just in the last year. And they of course are not all Nazis, thank God. And they're some very nice people. So I'm allowing, I mean, this was for me all about not allowing my power to be there because I was denying a whole side of myself. And so this side, as I'm allowing it, it's appearing, you know. There's like gifts too from that side, you know. It's not all good and bad.
Bettina Göring is in the film Bloodlines, which is screening this Friday, the 13th of November at the Jean Cocteau Theater, which is in the New Mexico Film Museum. It's a free event at 7 o'clock with a discussion afterwards. And I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very happy now to welcome Robert Sinn. He is going to be doing an evening of cabaret music in honor of National Adoption Awareness Month this Thursday, the 12th of November at 7 o'clock in the evening. And it's a benefit for an organization called Adoption Means Love. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So this is an organization basically dedicated to supporting the adoption of children who are now in foster care in the state of New Mexico. Is that correct?
Right, specifically in New Mexico. And also the funds from the concert will be raised to meet special needs of children in foster care or children who have been adopted whose family still cannot meet all their particular needs. Sometimes it's need for a computer, a special educational program that the schools can't quite do, things of that nature.
So kids who are in foster care right now, and we've talked about this on this program, often have a hard time getting adopted, especially if they're a little bit older.
That's right, right. And, so, and sometimes they don't get adopted, and in that case they can grow up in foster care, and we want to do all we can to see that that foster care experience is good for them. And meets their needs.
What are some of the kinds of special needs they have? You mentioned computers. What else?
Well, maybe a child who wants a bicycle or piano lessons, or maybe they have a particular learning disability which would benefit from a particular program that maybe the schools can't address fully, that kind of thing.
So you are doing a benefit, and you are a cabaret singer.
I'm a cabaret singer, and I'm working with a pianist, Ann Caldwell, who has been very supportive of my efforts here. And also, I'm very happy to announce that David Geist, who I work with every week at Pronzo, is going to come and do a special appearance with me also.
Wonderful. So this is on Thursday, the 12th of November at 7 o'clock at the Alterman Auction Gallery, which is at 345 Camino Monte Sol here in Santa Fe.
Right. And for people who have lived in Santa Fe for a long time, that was for many decades the La Union Protectiva building.
Ah, right. Mm-hmm. And English comedy and sentiment.
Right.
Uh-huh. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's I've had an interest in English material. It's not the only thing I'm interested in, but over the years I've collected quite a bit of it. And so I will be doing songs by Noel Coward, Ivor Novello, Gilbert and Sullivan. And then a very special thing, I was inspired as a song collector by Elsa Lanchester, the wife of Charles Lawton, who was a song collector. And so I'm going to do a song that she did about 1960. And David very kindly wrote the song down for me. I sort of hummed it to him, and we got it down on paper. It does not exist on paper. It did not exist on paper before. And it's a sort of a comic Spanish number called He Danced the Fandango All Over the Place. And I will also be playing castanets during that song for the first time.
So. Robertson, I want to thank you so much for being with us. And if people would like more information, they can call the AML Foundation office at 505-474-5211.
And we do ask people to make reservations because we want to provide adequate food and drink for the people who are coming. So we'd like a good count if we can get it.
Excellent.
And it's also by donation. There's no specific fee that anyone has to pay.
Oh, good to know. Well, I want to thank you for being here, and we're going to go out with a little bit of music.
Thank you.
I seem to be the victim of a cruel jest. It dogs my footsteps with the girl I love the best. She's just the sweetest girl that I have ever known. And yet, we never get to be alone. My car will meet her, and her mother comes too. It's a two-seater, still her mother comes too. At Zero's when we are free, for lunch and supper or tea. She loves to tango with me, and her mother does too. We buy her trousseau, and her mother comes too. Ask not to do so, still her mother comes too. She simply can't take a snub. I go and sulk at the club, then have a bath and a rub, but her brother comes too. We dine at Maxine's, and her mother comes too. How large a snack seems when her mother comes too. And when they're visiting me, we have our afternoon tea. She loves to sit on my knee, and her mother does too. To golf we started when her mother came too. Three bags I carted when her mother came too. She fainted just off the tee. My darling whispered to me, come dear, at last we are free. But her mother came too.
Thank you, David.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website, santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.